Welcome to Cut the Bull, an insightful podcast which addresses the news of the day and the cultural issues plaguing our society, bringing logic and context to these topics and discussing solutions too real for mainstream pundits. Now, here are your hosts, Charles Love and Wilfred Riley.
Hello and welcome to Cut the Bull. I am Charles Love, alongside my co-host Wilfred Riley, and our guest this week is Corey DeAngelis. He is the senior fellow at the American Federation for Children. Corey, welcome to the show.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. I put an emphasis on that children because, you know, later I sent you a link to something I'm doing in Chicago, and a lot of that is because I think a lot of the discourse around education has gotten away from, you know, what the focus should be on. We're focusing on all these other kids and not other things and not what's best for children. So I guess I want to start with you personally, though. So how you got into this fight for school choice and become such a leader in helping states and cities move in that direction.
Right. I'm glad you pointed out the name of my organization is For Children. We're the kids union, not the teachers union. And the school system for far too long, or at least for recently, has become more of a jobs program for adults than an education initiative for kids. And the teachers unions, we really should start calling them government school unions because they don't really represent the employees all that well either. The money doesn't make its way to the classroom. It goes towards administrative bloat and staffing surges, which is good for people like Randy Weingarten, who benefit from dues paying members in the system who makes over $500,000 a year. Not so good for the families or the teachers in the system that are already doing a good job. But to put it back on me, I'm at the American Federation for Children, and it's kind of a direct play on the American Federation of Teachers. We flipped it basically to be for the children as opposed to the adults. I got into this, my first experience with the concept of school choice. And for listeners, the way I would define school choice would be any in America, for the most part, if you live in a particular place, you are assigned to a school based on your address and you have to go there regardless whether you like it or not. We don't do this with basically anything else. We don't do this with grocery stores. You don't live in your house and then you have to go to the grocery store that you're assigned to. That happens to be run by the government. We don't do this with Medicaid vouchers you can take to private hospitals of your choice. We do this with food stamps. You can take them to any private grocery store that works for your family, and so on and so forth. The government school system is a racket. It's a monopoly. Has no incentive to spend taxpayer dollars wisely. So any policy that allows the funding that's meant for educating your child to follow them to a school other than the one that they're assigned to based on their zip code would be defined as school choice. So that could be another public school. That could be taking your kids' education dollars to a charter school. That could be a private school or a home-based education option as well. So the money following the child. For myself, I grew up in San Antonio, Texas. I live here now as well. And I went to public schools all K through 12, which we really should call them government schools because they're run by the government. They're not open to the public. They discriminate on the basis of zip code. They're not public goods in the economic sense. And they're not like public parks where, you know, if you want to go to any park you want, you can basically do so. Whereas families have actually gone to jail for lying about their address to get into better so-called public schools. And they've also been fined thousands and thousands of dollars for doing so too.
Kelly Williams in Akron, I had her on my show.
Right. That's right. I also had the opportunity, however, to go to something called a magnet school in high school. It was on the campus of my residentially assigned government-run school. They're both run by the government, but the magnet schools can have their admissions standards. They don't have as much monopoly power because they have to attract their customers, families. And I saw that was a good opportunity for me for 4 years. And I think other families should have opportunities when it comes to their education too, but it shouldn't be limited to schools that are run by the government. You should be able to go to take your kid to a private school and have the money follow the child as well, or a charter school or a home-based education option. I also got into this as a researcher. After I did my bachelor's and master's in economics, I went on and did my PhD in education policy at the University of Arkansas, where my first study actually looked at the Milwaukee Private School Choice Program, started in 1990. We had student-level data over a couple of decades from when the students were in school age to when they were about 30 years of age. We compared them to the kids in the public schools after controlling for whether they were in a single-parent household, their race, their income, their gender, all the usual background control variables, and found that after getting to use the school choice program in Milwaukee, several years later, until into adulthood, they were substantially less likely to commit crimes relative to the kids that were matched in the public schools. So I've done a lot of studies linking school choice to non-academic benefits. Families are choosing schools for a lot of reasons. It could be measured by a standardized test. That's part of the calculation. But families are also choosing based on safety, character development, and what we've seen with the most recent explosion of school choice expansion over the past few years, families are pushing for this because they're upset with the curriculum that's in the public schools that's not aligned with their values. So there's a whole bunch to unpack there. School quality is multidimensional. I've looked at effects on things like crime reduction, mental health improvements from school choice, safety improvements from school choice. And it's not all captured by a standardized test. So I think we can leave it there. I went into think tanks afterwards. I'm at AFC now. And, I kind of figured out, I thought about academia at first. I've done quite a few, maybe over 30 peer-reviewed studies on the topic. More productive than anyone else on the job market at the time. None of them called me back. I only applied, granted, to like three different universities, but they don't rank you based on your productivity and your academic success. They rank you and select you to get into these institutions of higher indoctrination based on your values and whether they align with their Marxist agenda in the colleges of education. I obviously was not aligned with them. They probably didn't want me to be their colleagues. So I'm at a think tanks, and I'm glad I took this route because I'm rewarded for my views as opposed to being punished for my views, which would be the case in the university system.
Right. Will, obviously, we're going to unpack the pros and cons of school choice. But when I mentioned the name of the organization and he talked about a play on the unions and talked about the unions, isn't there kind of a misconception for people on what they think the unions are there for? Like, I mean, we can knock them for not being there for the children, but, Karen Lewis in Chicago didn't make all that money to improve academic success for kids. That's not what they were paying her for, right? Give me the fattest contract with the least amount of work, the least amount of oversight, and the most days off. That's what we want you to do. So why don't people, you think, well, know that that's really what they're in the school business for? They're not in the school business to improve the schools. And I would hope they're not there to make them worse, but their job, their number one priority isn't to improve the schools. You're on mute.
Okay. Yeah, I think people don't know that because the teachers' union lies about it. I mean, they're extremely skilled, especially the AFT with this whole like slogans are focus grouped every couple of years, like for the children, all about our kids. I remember all children can and will learn from my high school. So the idea is that teachers are there, and at the level of the individual teacher, this is often true, to kind of shape and mold young people, and they're taking a massive pay cut to do so versus other jobs that they could be entering. Yeah, I would agree, Corey, that that is not true. But I mean, that's really not, and it's worth noting this for just fans of the show that might not have followed this sector too heavily. That's not what a union does. I mean, the teachers' unions are very typical professional peer unions. So what a union does is try to improve pay and working conditions for members of the union. It has nothing to do with the clientele being serviced. So, like the UAW, the United Auto Workers, like they're not trying to make cars that fall apart, I'm sure. But when they're negotiating with GM or Mopar or whatever, Ford, the goal is not to take more classes on auto maintenance to really just become the best master mechanic you can. I mean, I see both of you guys laughing, but like that, the teachers union pretends that, that this is kind of what they do. They talk constantly about pedagogy and so on down the line. No, the goal of a union is to improve benefits, pay, working conditions, so on for the members of the union. And the teachers' unions are very good at this. I mean, there have been organized, orchestrated state and I would presume nationwide campaigns to boost salaries. A big thing is tenure. Teachers tend to be promoted based on how long they've been teachers without absolutely failing rather than competence in the classroom. There's a huge backlash every time I've interacted with the teachers' union to the idea of merit pay. To the idea of letting folks such as myself, like college professors who have a class spare or adjuncts or something, come into the high school building. So yeah, the teachers union operates as a pretty standard professional union, which I'm not sure most people know. And that's just because they're not very upfront about that. And Corey, that's why I think the name of your group is to some extent an ingenious one. I mean, you're kind of saying, well, we're the group here that's coming forward for the kids. Right. Obviously, the best thing... So. I don't want to go on a lengthy rant here, but obviously the best thing for the kids would be having the best possible teachers. Whether you mean very low risks of quote unquote grooming, SA, other abusive kids, or at a deeper level, just the most knowledge of the subject matter, the highest test scores. Every time I've looked at what actually makes Black and poor white kids do well in school, one of the big things is just having a smart, capable teacher, not having a young teacher that's thrown into that school, unprepared for it, didn't do that well in the board test themselves, so on down the line. And there's a real problem here when it comes to the schools of education, actually, because I mean, you just described applying to some of these places and they're incredibly radical. The most assigned academic writer is it Ferrero? I always get his name wrong, but it's Brazilian Marxist.
Ferrero Rocher.
Yeah, oh, that's whatever funny. At least chocolate's useful. You end a date with it or something. This guy, but I mean, so that's the kind of thing that's being taught. And another point here, which is insulting a whole profession, is that test scores in education are really, really low. I mean, every year I look at the average on the board test, the SAT, the GRE by field. And political science is always like, okay, like, you know, we're the consultants, we send some people into academia. But education is always last. Like fourth from the bottom is high school serious teaching. The bottom is always special ed, which strikes me as really problematic. Elementary ed is right there, bottom five. So you have these people going in with SATs of 950 to these very politicized environments and emerging as kind of these radicals in the classroom. And that's why this isn't all teachers, but that's why you see like Libs of TikTok stock and trade, Chaya's, is showing people with like trans flag skirts and BLM pins as big as your hand and so on, and posters in the back with a cross out no sign over a gun. And the role is always early grades classroom teacher. So that really is something that we are seeing. And yeah, the teachers union plays into that. I don't know if there was really a Charles. I mean, you just phrased that as, what do you think about the unions? I mean, I think they're bad.
No, because I want to go. I know you didn't want to go off on a rant, but this is important to set up because I'm sure this is Corey's biggest adversary. So the last piece I want to say to the union is, all right, you did a great job of explaining what a union's purpose is. And that's what I always tell people. But it's also interesting that the people who support the AFT and the other teachers union so strongly are hypocritical because they don't seem to support all these other public sector unions. I'm not talking about the private ones. I'm talking about other public sector unions. So ask that same person who's at the teacher union rally, saying, well, we support our teachers, what they think about the police union.
Right.
So they do the same thing, just as they like to bring up examples of, say, the police union protecting a bad cop and say, see, they're terrible. But then you bring up an example of them, like you mentioned, you know, protecting the pension of a teacher who abused a child, they have nothing to say. So they don't really mean it either, right? It's all about trying to get a win for whatever their ideology is. And if that's through the
union. Just one quick story there. The two cities were from, New York and Chicago. Actually, last I looked, they still have the rubber room, which is if both of them still do. Yeah. So if you're a teacher and you're charged with something that's pretty serious, they're harassment of a student or something like that, and you're going through the procedure that could lead to firing, which in both NYC and the Shy is about a 3-year 2 years, 7 months, I think is the average process that doesn't lead to firing most of the time. You can't teach, but because of union rules, they still have to pay you. So there's literally a skyscraper in both cities. I mean, Chicago has an Ed building downtown that you will go to, and you'll sit in a well-appointed room and read the newspapers and go through the racing form and so on, and you'll be paid to do absolutely nothing. And this has been going on for decades. And this is the kind of thing that the teachers unions managed to get done. One final comment is really the police union. I actually have a problem with public sector unions in general.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I mean, like, I love our cops, do a great job, but like, there's something really weird and sort of bullshit about negotiating with yourself. Like, where you're a group of government workers, you generally, if you're at the higher levels of your profession, you know local politicians, you can turn out the vote for or against local politicians. This isn't you sitting down with the boss at GM. It's you sitting down with another public servant that you regularly interact with and, quote unquote, negotiating, meaning that if you don't get a win on such and such an issue, there are going to be consequences at the polls that everyone understands. And that's
right.
I don't see that public sector unions have improved most professions that I'm familiar with.
And last point before I go to you, Corey, what happens hypothetically, of course, hypothetically, if you elect a mayor who I don't know was an organizer for the teachers union and now he's supposed to be the one negotiating teacher contract? I mean, I don't think that ever happened in any major city like Chicago, but that would be bad if it did. Corey, go ahead.
Yeah, and the public sector unions lack any feedback mechanisms for their employer to actually change how they operate. In the private sector, if the employees wanted to go on strike at Walmart, for example, because they weren't paying the right amount or they didn't have the right benefits in other areas, well, if the employees went on strike, well, then the customers could vote with their feet to Safeway or another grocery store, and Walmart, the employer, would have an incentive to change things up or hire new people. If other people were willing to accept the benefits and pay in the public sector, and we saw this with the COVID school closures, the public sector unions, the teachers unions, understood that they could leverage the closures, holding children's education hostage to secure ransom payments from the taxpayers. And guess what? The customers were the ones feeling the pain, not the employers. The customers, the parents, got the short end of the stick, and they were scrambling, trying to pay out of pocket for pandemic pods, for homeschooling expenses, and then also trying to pay out of pocket for private school tuition and fees. All the meanwhile, the public sector, the government schools, kept their doors closed, got all your tax money anyway. And I think that really was a breaking point for parents. And I want to hit on one more thing on the nature of the government school unions is that, you know, Will kind of pointed out correctly that their job is they're not the kids union, the teachers union. They're in it for the adults to try to make it as easy as possible for them and to try to make them be paid as well as possible for not doing a great job. And, you know, their opposition to merit pay talks about that. It really speaks to that as well. They're really focused on the lowest common denominator within the profession. That's why you have teachers that are doing a good job. They look around and say, why is this dude getting paid the same as me when I'm doing a better job? I'm busting my rear end. I'm going to go somewhere else where I'm actually rewarded for doing a good job so that the best leave the profession. And if you look over time with how much money we've poured into the system, it actually doesn't make it to the teachers that are doing a good job, regardless of merit pay. When you look at average salaries, for example, between 1970 and about 2020, according to the National Center for Education Statistics, per student education spending has increased by about 160% nationwide after adjusting for inflation. But teacher salaries have only increased by about 10% on average in real terms over the same period. Yeah, a lot of that goes towards non-salary benefits like pension benefits. So that's not included in that. But if you're just looking at salaries, what they usually spend their money on when they get more funding funneled into the system is they put more money towards administrative bloat and just adding more staff into the building. But if you're paying more money towards the administrators, if you're paying more money in Texas, where I live, we have about a handful of superintendents who make more than the president of the United States, who make over $400,000 a year to not really provide any meaningful outcomes for the kids. And if you look between 2000 and 2019, according to data from, again, NCES, they found that over that period, student enrollment has increased by about 8%. The same for teachers in the system has increased by about 8%. But if you look at administrative bloat over time, administrators in the system, it has increased by about 90%. So again, it's become more of a jobs program for adults than an education initiative for kids. And you, and Charles, you pointed out some hypocrisy when it comes to the union supporting, some people in the system will support their union, but nobody else's union. But there's an even more insidious form of hypocrisy right in your hometown of Chicago, where the teachers union boss there, Stacey Davis Gates, just got embarrassed on CNN of all places for getting called out for sending her own kid to a private school this year, after just last year, she said school choice was racist. And she said private schools were segregation academies. And now she sends her own kid to a private school, which I don't blame her for doing that. Everybody should seek out the best options for their kids. But you also and she also fights tooth and nail against the school choice program that Illinois Democrats just got rid of. For low-income kids, it's school choice for me, but not for the hypocrisy, and it reeks of elitism and paternalism. A lot of them will outright say, I don't think Stacey has said this herself, but other opponents of school choice have been caught saying that, well, you know, I can choose, I can figure it out, but low-income families, they just can't figure it out. But the thing is, parents of all backgrounds know their kids' education needs better than bureaucrats sitting in offices hundreds of miles away.
Right. Now, I'm going to try here. I'm not like Denzel Washington or anything, but I'm trying to do this in my best acting performance here. So, Corey, why do we need school choice? I mean, how bad can the schools really be? They're not that bad, are they?
Well, you look at Baltimore, Maryland, you have dozens of public schools have 0% proficiency rates. None of the kids are at proficient levels in reading or math. So
I have to stop you there.
This is the case in Chicago, too.
I was just going to say, I have to stop you there.
This is not just fair at Baltimore.
1%, baby.
Right. It's funny. I have to stop you there because I keep bringing up this event I'm doing in Chicago, because before the call, before we started recording, I was on the phone with a friend of mine getting ready for this event we're doing in Chicago, and I sent them some data. I sent it to you, Will, if you want to look at it. So I sent them, I picked out
I've
some
got
school.
It in the inbox.
Yeah, I just emailed it to you.
No, I just looked at it.
Really? That's crazy.
And Chicago spending
like window on my browser.
I picked out some select schools from all over the city, different neighborhoods, different demographics, everything, about 30 schools, and I put them in, and I went through U.S. News and World Report, the National Report Card, the CPS site, all of them. Pulled all the data together and I sent it to him. He's like, this can't be right. He's like, what do you mean? I said, I sorted it by reading proficiency. He's like, some of these schools are zero. I'm like, yeah, that's bad. I mean, it's worse than we thought. But he's like, no, I'm saying it's right. Maybe it just didn't pull the data in or something. I was like, no, that's the data. What do you mean? He's like, no, there's no way a school could be zero. Maybe it just didn't load. I said, okay, what about the school that's two? That low?
Oh, that could. I think that's right. Yeah, it's not zero, but maybe two. But either way, it's horrendous, two. Right? And the New York City public schools spend about $40,000 a year. Chicago's spending, I think, about $30,000 per year, whereas the private schools probably cost about half that amount on average in Chicago. Some a lot more, obviously. Some a lot right. less. Mm-hmm. But even let's assume that the proficiency rates were at 100%. Well, you know what? Then you should have nothing to worry about. If the public schools are doing a fantastic job, and you shouldn't have to fear a little bit of competition. Families will continue sending their kids there. But at the same time, families, again, are choosing schools for a lot of different reasons. Could be standardized test scores. But you could have the best school also that teaches kids academically on average, and they do a really good job for a lot of the kids, a majority of the kids even. But what if it's not the right fit for a particular kid because they're not interested in the mission? Maybe they have a special need. In fact, we have families going to courts all across the country right now. Not a lot of people know this, actually. It's within the Individual Disabilities Education Act, IDEA, federal education law, says that if a school district is not meeting your kid's special needs under federal law, you can sue the district to get them to pay for your special needs child to go to a private school that's more likely to meet their needs. Now, who are the families that are most likely to be able to jump through all the hoops? It's probably the more advantaged families. That's why I say all states should just pass school choice, and you shouldn't have to go to a judge to figure this out. Shouldn't have to come down to federal education law. People should just say, hey, this $30,000 in Chicago, that's already being spent on my kid, I should be able to take it to a private school if it's better. If not, I'll continue sending my kids to a public school. And it might be because there might be a specialized mission at the school. It might be faith-based. That families want a religious opportunity, might be right? So there's a whole lot of different reasons. And, that should be up to the parent, and families have individual diverse needs that are never going to be met by definition by a one-size-fits-all system.
Will, couldn't it also be? I mean, he talked about the carve-out for special needs parents. I'm sure many of the families on the south and west side of Chicago would like that carve-out for discipline and safety issues. What if it's not safe for me to go to the school? Can I sue for them to pay for my kid to go to a different school? So like you said, it could be a myriad of reasons. It could be academic or what have you, but
there are some programs that do that. Well, real quick, Charles, that do. So the school choice initiatives that we've seen recently have been universal. Everybody's eligible regardless of background. But before, there was a lot of incremental reform. You know, it would be, you know, low income families are eligible first, then maybe special needs families in this state. Maybe we add military later on. It was kind of this incremental ratchet up of different families becoming eligible over time. Now it's kind of gone from 0 to 100. Everybody's kind of eligible. But before, there was also kind of these carve outs for families who had kids who were bullied so bad in the public school that they felt like there was a safety issue that required them to go to a private school that was more aligned with their values or whatever it may be. And Florida, for example, had one of these programs called the Hope Scholarship Program. And so that's still on the books today, I believe. They're universal now, so it's kind of redundant. They don't really need it anymore. They might have consolidated it. But that could be an idea for states that have more Democrat opposition, more bluish states, to maybe, hey, how are you going to come out against one special? And they do. They do it anyway. They will reject any form of school choice, whether it's for special needs kids, whether it's for kids who are bullied, whether kids who are in a dangerous situation, they don't care, right? because they know that once a little bit of families can start to use the programs, it's going to show that it's not going to destroy the public schools. It actually makes them better. Competition's a rising tide that lifts all boats. And I think that's why they're freaking out about Arizona right now, because Arizona was one of the first to go all in and go universal. Their public schools have gotten better over time. Same thing in Florida. They were at the middle of the pack on the nation's report card a couple decades ago. Now they're at the top after adjusting for student demographics across states, according to the Urban Institute's America's Gradebook. And Florida spends way less than the national average.
Right.
And they're getting some of the best outcomes, no matter how you slice the data.
Oh, Will, isn't the problem with the people who are pushing back against school choice not so much the school choice? It's a step before that. I would have to, if I were like Corey, that's his trade, so he's going to go. But I would, even before I talked about whether you should offer school choice, I'm like, shouldn't you wonder why parents are frustrated, why kids aren't succeeding, and why people would want to leave? Like, what are you doing that, like, your own data is saying you have a large percentage of schools that are failing? I would say easily over 50% of the schools in Chicago are failing. Why aren't you, as not the teachers, not teaching you, the administrators, CPS, the people running the school, saying we have to do better because we're failing kids? Why isn't that the first thing in their mind, and not how do we tie the kids to put chains on the door like Joe Clark and keep you from leaving?
That's a really good moral question, but I think the answer to some extent is because morals aren't real and people are guided by pragmatic concerns. Like, I'm saying that kind of half jokingly, but I mean, that really is sort of the answer. Like, I recently read some research on whether religious people are more ethical than non-religious people, and the answer is no. And interestingly, both groups, even by the standards of like the tie-wearing consultant types reading the data, were pretty damn unethical in terms of rates of cheating on your wife and all that. But the difference was that religious people or believers in anything, like I would put wokeism in this category, tend to just simply rationalize away predatory, amoral behavior by saying it's necessary for some kind of made-up reason. I mean, from karma to racism. And thus are actually willing to engage in more of it very often than people who just have to dead-on confront what they're doing. So I don't want to take this into a sideline about people's beliefs and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, because here I'm thinking we're talking decades, different leadership. I mean, they can't all come in and just say, screw the
kids. It
doesn't
matter, though. I mean, like, it's just the
whites.
It's just like we see this with racism all the time. So, like, in the South, now, even then, I mean, there was Black Wall Street, so on. It was still obviously possible to be successful as a Black person. Blacks or whites could both independently buy land. But, you know, in the 1940s, it was a lot harder to get rich if you were Black. You could blame racism. But we haven't seen a decline in the rate of unsuccessful people blaming racism between, like, I think it's 1951 and now. So the simple fact that something's not true doesn't affect your ability to say it. I mean, in a lot of the big cities, Charles, where you and I, probably Corey as well, have talked with local politicians who are often Black or kind of ethnic urban white guys. I mean, the stories, the explanations have been the same for decades. I mean, like in Detroit or in Chicago, it's always, well, all the money's in the suburbs. You know, big corporations are moving from the city to the suburbs. It's impossible to we don't have enough resources is the classic BS line. So I think.
And how much more than do you need? It's always just more. They never give you a number.
Right.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's something I've really noticed in these conversations, because I'll sometimes, some I picked up actually from Big Chuck here, but I'll try to give the other side the argument and say, okay, I mean, you think the argument's lack of resources. We have a tax system in this country. What's the appropriate amount of resources you think would fix this problem? And nobody ever says it. It's just like, well, you can't really calculate that in the context of the lingering systemic impact of white supremacy on the brain of a Black woman. I mean, go on.
Didn't Chicago get like $4 billion in COVID relief to reopen the schools? Then the union voted to strike in 2022. I mean, 2 weeks to slow the spread turned into 2 years to flatten a generation.
They're being sued.
$4 billion might as well be a guy in a white hood setting your house on fire, Corey. $4 billion to even bring up $4 billion in the context of the institutional supremacy holding down the children of Chicago. It's offensive, I'll tell you. No, but like these are the kind of responses that we've all heard at board meetings, sessions with local leaders, so on. I guess my point is there is a preset series of explanations that urban bureaucrats, especially on the left, proffer up anytime someone makes these sort of points. Education, to me, the problem in American education isn't money at all. Like, if you look at Hood and Holler schools, and I've looked at both, sometimes they get a little more funding than suburban kids, sometimes a little less. But it's in that same range of well over $10,000 per kid, usually well over 15. I mean, I've seen figures up to 30. And you have to ask at some point, how much does a book cost? Like, why would you be unable to educate kids as well as kids are educated in Vietnam or Ethiopia or, for that matter, South Korea with these kind of financial packages? So I think the things that are said are excuses. But I have a question for kind of both of you guys, because both of you have looked at education more than I have. I mean, Charles, I think you're still on a Alpha World City school board. How do you get a school that has a success rate of 0%? One sentence to follow, but I mean, like, proficient isn't gifted. It's not advanced. It's not the highest level.
Right.
Proficient just means you're at grade level or a little above and you can read.
Right.
So, like, every year, the percentage of Black people that miss that level is 70% or higher. Whites about 50%. Chicago, all groups combined, 1%. How? How do you have 1% success rates? I'm genuinely curious as a business guy.
You're the guest, so I'll let you go first.
I was going to say, I thought you were asking, how do we fix it? I think one way to fix it is to reduce the bar for passing all the way to zero. Then everybody's passing. And that's one way to do it. I think some states are going in that direction. We're all awesome. Everybody gets a trophy. I think, you know, in some of these places, they are, you know, they're just warehousing the kids. I mean, some people call them factory schools. But, you know, they're sitting in front of videos all day and not actually teaching the kids really well. And they have no incentive to do so. I mean, it could be one, something that Will mentioned earlier. You have people entering the system, knowing how the system's set up, knowing it's going to be an easier job with high job security, pretty good benefits, mm-hmm. and you're basically never going to lose your job. Or I think the more likely explanation to me is that it has to do with the incentives baked into the system itself. If you are assigned to a grocery store and it was run by the government and you had to pay for it through your taxes, and they were serving you rotten food, they were giving you food poisoning, or even worse, like in socialist countries, the shelves were empty, and you couldn't go anywhere else, they're just going to say, we need more money, because that's what they're going to get, right? They're going to say what they want to make their job easier, but then to also enrich themselves. Who cares about the customers? Right. But if you could say, hey, I'm going to go somewhere else and you're going to shut down if you don't actually check your shelves and make sure that the product is not rotten, then they'll have to up their game in response right. to that competition. And 26 of the 29 studies on this topic nationwide have found positive effects of private school choice competition on the outcomes in the public schools. This is the main argument from the other side. They'll say school choice will destroy these public schools. It's one, I think, is an admission of failure. They're not confident in their product. They think everybody's going to leave. But then two,
the product has a 1% success rate in big cities. I mean, I don't want to interrupt.
They're not confident. They know it better than we do. They're inside the system. And in fact, a study by AEI, actually, we're talking about Chicago a lot today because Charles is there. But they, I believe, reported back in 2014, it's probably a lot higher now, that the percentage, the teachers in the system in Chicago were like 4 or 5 times as likely as the general public to send their own kids to private schools.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
People have theorized, well, it's because they know the system. They know what goes on more than anybody else does. So that they know to send their kids somewhere else.
Well, let me try.
It's not like
they're
making a lot more than everybody else. It's not because they're more wealthier, and that's why right. they can send their kids.
They just know
school.
You got to get. I had no friends in Chicago that sent their kids to public school. None of them. And most of them were not rich. But unfortunately, I have a different reason why it's so hard. And I don't know. The short answer to your question, Will, is I don't know. Because I have an idea, but there's two reasons why you can't do it. The only thing you could really do, and this is drastic only because you let it get so bad, because your question was specific, how do you get from zero? You have to assess the kids and take all the failing kids out and teach them differently. They need to be separate from the kids who are proficient or better, and you need to teach them, you know, at where they are and work at their level and incrementally get better. The problem is the left will never let you other the kids by taking them out. They're doing the opposite. They're saying everybody should go to selective enrollment school, even if they're, you know, mm-hmm. bringing down Walter Payton and Bronx Science and things of that nature. So they won't do it from equality standpoint. The other issue is it would work. Now, I'm not saying it's specifically, you know, the cause, you know, correlation is, it may not necessarily mean that that's the cause of it. But if you look at more than race, you have to look at economically disadvantaged categories, like the free lunch program. If you track the schools based on that, the more students that are in the school, that, and of course, English language learners, the higher, the lower the proficiency rate goes, right? So the problem is, if you only have 10 or 15% of your kids that were from economically disadvantaged families, you could do that. But in Chicago, it's closer to 50%. There's no way to house 50% of the students at an alternative school and teach them differently. So there's physically no place to put them, right? Even if you gave them $20 billion, what are you going to build buildings? They'll be out of school by the time that they're done. So there's really no way to do it. I mean, as bleak as it sounds, but like he said, either get your kids out, get them into the best schools that are there, or, you know, and then the other thing we don't talk about as much is parents, part of the reason why the school choice works is because the people who will take advantage of it, it skews to be like the immigrant story, right? Why are the immigrants so smart? People in Nigeria must be smarter than Americans. No, the people who are willing to take the chance to leave, you know, self-select to be the people with more drive. So the people who do this are going to be the people like, oh, there's an opportunity. I'm on the internet trying to find it. I'm doing the best for my kids. The parents who are just like dropping them off as daycare centers are still going to get left behind with the new school, the new money, and all those things, unless somebody can get them to wake up and say, you need to invest in your kids' future. So
I want to respond to that real quick, because that sounds a little bit like one of the arguments people make against school choice, is that the kids who don't have the, you know, the parents who are, you know, motivated enough to go and seek out alternative options, they're going to be left behind in the public schools, which is why I brought up a second ago that competition is a rising tide that lifts all boats. So they don't want to bleed more customers. They're going to have to change something. Right. So even if you're not actively choosing, there are residual benefits.
Right. But then other people who do choose.
Yes. And then two, school choice increases parental involvement by definition. If you don't have the money to pay for private school, you're just going to say, okay, well, I'm just going to, you know, send my kids off to the government and they're going to kind of take care of them for 7 hours a day. I'm just going to wash my hands with it. But if I now know I can take that $20,000, $10,000, $15,000, whatever the amount is in your state, $15,000 per kid, if I can take that to another school, I'm going to think a little bit about this a little more, and I'm going to start searching for alternatives and become more involved. It's not going to be every single family, right? You can't make perfect the enemy of the good, but it will be an improvement at the margins. In particular, you'll have more families have a strong incentive to look these things up and to become more involved.
Right.
There's actually a study on this. There's not a ton. I found one. Is one from 2018 by Cornell researchers. I didn't do it. Sometimes when I do it, people say, oh, of course you're going to find that you did it. And it's like, well, shouldn't that actually give me more credibility if I do the studies? But let's cite someone else, some Cornell researchers. And they found that as school choice programs expanded in a location, the online search activity for private schools and other alternatives increased in those areas. So it's not a perfect study, but it's pretty, it's correlational, showing that as school choice has introduced, you give the families the power to choose, they're going to start to choose. They're going to start to research. They're going to become more involved. And so I think this kind of solves that problem in a couple of ways.
What were you going to say, Will?
Yeah. So I was just actually just about to bring this up again. One of the things that both you guys said, which I think is really important, is something that I notice is almost totally taboo when you talk about education, which is that the biggest predictor of how a school is going to do is the kids in the school. And this is, again, just an obvious, plain fact. It's just almost never talked about. I mean, I mentioned that old slogan, all children can and will learn, and there's an expectation there kind of to the same level. Like, if you ever read No Child Left Behind, I'm sure all of us have. I mean, there are all these crazy Lake Wobegon expectations. Like, everyone in each of, I think it's 11 student subpopulations, is going to perform at or above the average for their group, if not
which
everybody.
Impossible.
Not every one of an odd number of groups can outperform. I mean, it's mathematically illiterate, but it's getting back to like my one core thrust, though. Like, obviously, the majority of human beings, like the tested IQs for all the major ethnic groups in the USA, are actually really normal from a global perspective. Most people aren't idiots. You know, the biggest predictor of how well you do in school, Brookings Institute 2017, how much you hit the books. But there are radically different levels of commitment that people at any given time bring to school. There are big effects of bad parenting, things like drug use, things like abuse in the home. So if you are in Chicago, in Detroit, and by the way, because we often think of this as a Black or Latino issue, if you're in a lot of these schools in Appalachia, I mean, you're going to have just unavoidable real problems. And to the extent if your kid is getting bullied, you can take your kid out of that school. That's good. That's a great thing. And to the extent that moving people out of those schools creates some competition, so the school can't just bumble along doing what it's done for the past 30 years. I mean, a lot of our schools are like 8% proficient around here. I mean, that also is good. But the predictor for how well a school does is who's in the school. Who are the kids? Who are their parents? And that's what people really mean when they say, is it a good school? They don't mean like, does this have nice physical plant? Interestingly enough, I mean, I used to play sports. I think we all did. You go to schools in the ghetto, much less in like new exurbs where they can't read all that well either. These are magnificent buildings. These are D2 level football facilities and so on, all that. But the issue is what's going on in the classrooms. I mean, we just saw a very nice, if you look at campus, a Missouri school where there was an interracial student brawl where one unfortunate young woman was almost beaten to death. So that's what people mean. Is this a bad school? Like, who's going there? Is it across the street from the projects, or for that matter, a trailer park? And it's something you've got to deal with. Like, you can't have all schools perform at the same level. The question for the bad schools, to put it brutally, is how do you get from 1% to 25%? I mean, how do you stop crime from happening in the school right now? And those questions seem to be almost unasked. The assumption is that the teachers, or like society, kumbaya, like racism or something, is at fault for what's going on in these buildings. No, it isn't.
Now, I want to get to some of the challenges and the things that people may say, so you can slap them down if you can about school choice. But I just text you both a photo. It is a download from the CPS's equity 5-year plan. Look at that.
Sounds like
communist. Tell me what it says in writing. We should all hold it up and see if we can see it.
Really,
what
is a fucking 5-year plan? It's a bit on the nose, isn't it?
I know, isn't it?
Equitable outcomes is what it says. So don't tell me that's not what they're trying to say. They literally said it on the first page of the report. How are you going to have equitable outcomes when the students have different ability, the parents have different amount of money and different levels of education, so they come to school because they can read because the father's a doctor. There's so many different things that come into play. How are you just going to have the same outcomes? I mean, some kids may just work harder. That as a goal is destined to fail. So you're setting yourself up to lose.
The answer is what one of Mao's best commissars said, if I recall, after we got him, after he defected, and it translates literally to, we just made the shit up. Like, I'm not trying to be funny or crude, but how do you get 100 men who are Chinese peasants perfectly in line when it comes to their appreciation of great leader plus their calligraphy? You literally just have like an out-of-work scribe write down the same crap for all of them and say, aced it. And that's what the schools are doing. I mean, when you see something like, I did a paper on charter schools for Tom Donaldson over at America's Majority Foundation. We found a slight definite charter edge. There were also some bad charter schools. There were a lot of bad public schools, too. So, I mean, it was kind of the result we expected. But, like, looking at that, I noticed that in public schools, the Black SAT average in my pool of schools was like 960. In the charter schools, it was a little higher. It was like 1,000, a little under. I'd have to pull the paper up. But the college admission rate for African Americans was 63%. The college admission rate for whites who weren't doing all that much better was 77%. And what that means is, like, you got everyone, both these groups of kids, 90%+ out of the school, you know, and when you're learning it again, an SAT 950 level. And then both groups of kids, like 70-odd%, accepted to college. So you're just facilitating this kind of fake competition. That's what we've got right now between like woke academia and the teachers unions in high school. Like, you have a note for the parents, and I'll shut up. You have no idea what your kids' grades and all that mean unless you sit down with them. You do a family story time every so often or something. Like, I have some younger mentees. I asked one guy what he was getting. He told me 3.4, like solid B+. You know, okay, do we buy the kid a steak? Well, not really. Then you learn that 70% of the people in the school have an A average. How? What does it mean?
The kid at Harvard? Because that sounds like the Harvard
average. No, the kid was a student.
You said B plus, not A minus.
He's not going to KSU. He was hooping with us. And it was just sort of like, yeah, you know, I had a B+ in high school. I've gotten an A minus in college. And it's cool. But like, if you look at the high school, then by major, like, that's often going to be below the cut. What does it mean? Not a whole lot. So you need to work that out. You need to know the GPA average at your kid's high school. Are there AP classes that can technically let you get a 5.6 when you got a 3.8? I mean, it's funny math.
Right.
I think this also has a lot to do with the history of compulsory education in America. You look at the first compulsory education law in Massachusetts, and you had Horace Mann, the father of public education, was their education secretary, went over to Prussia, modern-day Germany, and learned about their compulsory education law, which was started to make obedient soldiers in the army after they lost the war, I believe. And he brought it over to America, and you still have a lot of these tenets of obediency within the public school system that is more important than actually learning how to read and write and do math. And I think it's also, you kind of see this with Live to TikTok that was mentioned earlier. You have teachers getting into the system to try to raise other people's kids into their ideology, not their parents' ideology.
Right.
And so if you're focused on, you know, what social justice causes in the classroom, or if you're focused on, you know, the LGBTQs as opposed to the ABCs, the kids probably aren't going to learn all that much academically, but they are learning something. So like when you see those graphs that show, you know, spending has gone up by, tripled over the past few decades, but then you see the test scores have flatlined, you know, over the past few decades, or decreased in some cases, we're probably not looking at the right outcome. It might be that kids are becoming more woke. Might be the kids are, moving further left because the schools tend to be controlled by people who are, look at the teachers unions. You look at AFT, who we mentioned at the beginning of this, American Federation of Teachers, 99.9% of their campaign contributions went to Democrats in 2022 and so far in 2024 as well. This has been happening for decades. And so now when you have things like school choice get brought up, one, they are terrified that they're going to lose their monopoly when it comes to funding. But I think even more importantly, they're more terrified of losing their monopoly on the minds of other people's children.
Yeah.
And they see it as a way to they don't even have to have kids. They can shape the American culture with the 50 or so million kids that are churned through the public education system nationwide each and every year, cohorts of 50 million kids.
I think we're all going to say something about that. That's a good point. But that's actually a big problem that I once called cuckoo syndrome in a column. We often on the right, now, I mean, I need to step my game up myself, but the expectation is most people are functionally normal with the opposite sex, have jobs. We're going to produce children. And those children are going, the idea is sort of, well, if our opponents don't we take over the world? You hear this in Israel, USA, France. The answer is no, because what our opponents tend to produce is people who teach and indoctrinate children.
Yep.
So that's where the whole grooming thing hits so hard to a lot of people on the left, including people I know. Like, I've had friends who are college professors ask, well, do you think I'm a groomer? I teach some of this stuff. And I mean, the answer can vary depending on the situation. But the basic idea is you get these ideas that are very, very plausible and very appealing to angry young people. Anything Gramscian, anything Marxist, you plunge it in. And then the kid who used to believe X believes Y. So that's why there's no simple solution to this battle between, you know, the two sides, the left and the right. That goes back to the French Assembly several hundred years ago. And, you know, they've remained about 50-50 in most Western countries since. So that's something to keep in mind.
Right.
Yeah, I think we need to stop thinking of the American education system as a way to churn out kids that are literate and that are highly educated in the basics, because I think it's been captured by people who see it more as a way to raise other people's children. And I think that's why I'm really attracted to the idea of homeschooling. I have a kid on the way, my first child, actually. We're planning on homeschooling because, you know, it seems like sending your kid off to the government school is outsourcing the role of parenting to government employees for 7 hours a day for 13 years of their lives. If you're assigned to a good school that you know doesn't indoctrinate them from what you can tell, that might be okay. Or it might be a step up to be able to choose a private school. That's why I'm supportive of school choice, that at least you can choose the community that's kind of helping you raise your kid for 7 hours a day. But homeschooling is probably the purest form of just education in the way that you see fit for your child.
Now that's is a good segue to, you know, I've mentioned that I did want to talk about some of the challenges that and the pushback that you get on school choice, and you can reply to some of those, and then we can end with some of your wins. But I think some of them are a lot deeper, but I know the one that you and I talked about at first when we talked about what's the problem with the schools is, like, we talk about how bad the schools are, he's like, well, you need to get your kids out. You talked about that 50 million number, so that's why I'm going to start with that one. Now, it doesn't mean don't do it. You know I'm pro-school choice, but others I have had conversations with that they look at it like the solution of the indoctrination and what's happening to kids. But if the trend is, even if it's going in the right direction, but it's a small percentage of people at the beginning as it goes along, every year that's all these kids that are still failing in school at best, and failing and being indoctrinated at worst. So to those who, what do you say to the people who say, well, school choice is not going, we're not going to go from, you know, 95% of kids in public school to 40 in 5 or 10 years. You know, what do we do in the interim while we're pushing for school choice? What happens with the public schools?
Yeah, I'll say the solutions aren't mutually exclusive. You can push for school choice while pushing for other things too. And so I think this is why like Moms for Liberty has been very successful, and I support their group's efforts as well in flipping the school boards. So, we can do, it should and can be a multi-pronged approach. We should push for school choice as an escape valve, especially since when you have more leverage in the relationship with your school board, if you can take your money and your kid with you, the school board, instead of labeling you as a domestic terrorist, as we saw with the National School Boards Association, you know about this, but for your listeners, sending a letter to the Biden administration's Department of Justice to label parents who are protesting about curriculum they disagreed with as quote unquote domestic terrorists. Well, if you actually were viewed as a customer as opposed to a nuisance, maybe they'll actually listen to you instead of try to bully and silence you into submission. Maybe they won't cut your mic off when you're trying to read books out loud that they think is okay for your kids with other adults, but not you in a meeting room with members of the community who are more likely to be a proper age to listen to that conversation. They won't cut off your mic. They'll actually listen to you. And so you can have school choice, have nobody move. You can have nobody leave the school, or maybe just a handful of people leave the school. The whole relationship changes because it gives you power. It gives you a stronger say even within the public school system, because now they're going to have to scratch their head and think about how they treat you. And if they don't, well, you can go somewhere else. They'll lose funding. Maybe they'll change in the future. And maybe if they don't listen to you, they'll be held accountable at the ballot box too. And we also got to play it there. To take over the school boards too. Right, but at the end of the day, I think, you know, it still traps you and you're still in that one size fits all system, which is why I think school choice is necessary. It may not be sufficient to get to the utopia that we want.
What about
necessary?
What about where you go? What about the arguments where they say that homeschooling is your home. That's different. But all the schools are bad, and how the private, you know, like I learned from my friend Ashley over at Paris Unite, that some of the private schools, including the elite private schools, are even worse they're better academically, but worse from an indoctrination standpoint. So what about the argument that, you got school choice, but there's really no good place to send the kids?
When you build it, they will come. When you give parents the funding, you put the money into the hands of the families. Supply is not fixed. If supply will meet demand. In the current status quo, you're only going to have a certain type of private school. And in your town, it might not even be a private school you'd ever want, right? But if families have the option to take their money with them, you'll have more private schools sprout up. And we saw this in Florida. We have data from Step Up for Students, for example. I cited in my Wall Street Journal piece on this called The Little Red Schoolhouse Could Do With a Little Competition. I was refuting the argument that, oh, well, we're a rural place, so we don't have a lot of options. So, we don't need to vote for school choice, even though I'm in a Republican district. I'm going to vote with the teachers union instead and block education freedom, is the argument we hear in Texas sometime by the guys who were endorsed by the state affiliate of Randy Weingarten's union. But in Florida, since they've expanded school choice over the past decade or two, the number of private schools in their most rural counties has doubled. So that's not perfect. That's not tripled. That's not quadrupled. I don't know what the perfect number is, but that does show a trend towards supply meeting demand. I don't know how long it would take.
Right.
I don't know how, you know, that was over a decade or two of a time period in Florida. But you did mention also of homeschooling, that you don't have to start another brick and mortar school to homeschool.
Right.
Well, you may say, well, what if both of the families are, you know, have a full-time job and they're super busy? That's why I think one-room schoolhouses, or what most people call now micro schools, are very, you know, that's a lot easier to set up than a you know, a big private school that you would usually think of. You can set up these small 10-student micro schools.
Yeah.
You can do it in someone's household. That's what they were doing during the pandemic in New York City and Chicago. They
Natasha
pods.
Fields in Chicago told me that surprisingly, Illinois is one of the easiest states to homeschool. So definitely look into that if that's something you're into. And then one other one is that people say that you talk about you don't like the government control, but that when the funding is going with the kid, it's still government funding. So the funding is still being managed by the government,
and
question that it's going to give more control to the people running.
Yeah, don't make perfect the enemy of the good. Randi Weingarten has made the same argument. She's not some anti-government libertarian. She's a big government socialist. And if you're on her side and not my side, you're probably on the wrong side when it comes to education freedom. She's doing it to keep her gravy train going, to block education freedom and to keep kids in her failing government schools. But look, every private school choice initiative that has ever been implemented in the U.S. has always been voluntary. Every family can make the cost-benefit decision for their own families. Every school can make the cost-benefit decision to accept the funding or not. And so that decision should be up to the parents. And in fact, if you look at states that have more education freedom when it comes to school choice programs, they tend to have less regulation of home and private education than states that have less school choice. So you think of places like New York, they have the worst homeschooling laws in the book, according to HSLDA. Mm-hmm. You look at places like Massachusetts, Rhode Island, they're ranked the worst according to HSLDA. They have no private school choice initiatives. You look at places like Oklahoma and Iowa, they have universal school choice and they have the least regulated homeschooling in the country. So I would say this is a separate issue from school choice. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the government can already regulate private and home education without giving families an option. And they did so in Oregon in 1922. They outlawed private education altogether. And that wasn't because of a school choice initiative. That was because you had authoritarians who wanted to control the minds of other people's children. And I'll say one last thing on this topic, because I do get this a lot, is that school choice could actually reduce the likelihood of government overreach in at least three ways. One, you have fewer kids being indoctrinated in these government schools, being taught that big government is the answer to all of their problems. And then they'll be less likely, if they have the choice to go to a private school that's aligned with their family's values, they'll be less likely to vote to regulate private and home education in the future. Two, politics is all about organized interests and people fighting for what they want through the political process. And if you have more families benefiting from private and home education through school choice, you're going to have a broader coalition, a bigger tent to fight back against authoritarian government overreach in the future. So look, take the win, take the W, or else you're going to be stuck with the L. Don't make perfect the enemy of the good. I'm against government regulation. I got into this as a libertarian. I've written lots of papers about the unintended consequences of regulations in education. And so, I'm on the right side of this. Randi Weingarten is not the person to be siding with on this issue. And I probably have like a couple other, I did a debate on this in New York City, actually. Will, you weren't there, but it was hosted by the Soho Forum. And I debated Stefan Kinsella. He's a pretty well-known in libertarian circles attorney. And we did it Oxford style. He took the anti-school choice libertarian position of it being big government. I don't know if you can hear my cat, but she's hanging out with me right here. And I took the pro-school choice position, saying not to make perfect the enemy of the good. And I was victorious with that Oxford style debate. And I also wrote about this at Fox News with Jason Bedrick. He's at the Heritage Foundation, mm-hmm. in an article called "School Choice Benefits Homeschoolers Too." So if you want to look that up.
Yeah, I saw that. So, you obviously been making gains. If you want to end by telling us, you know, some of your wins and where they can find you and what people can do, right. That'd be good.
Right, there's the cat. The teachers unions have overplayed their hand and awakened a sleeping giant, which happens to be parents who want more of a say in their kids' education. So over the past 3 years, after the unions lobbied the CDC to make this to make the schools close as long as possible, and after the remote learning exposed what was happening in the classroom, parents started to push back at school board meetings. They started to push back for school choice policies. And in the past 3 years, we've had now 11 states pass universal school choice policies. Before 2020, we had zero states that were universal, meaning everybody was eligible. So now we've gone from zero states having universal to over 20% of states having everybody having access to take their kids' education dollars to the public or private school that works best for their kids. And these are all red states controlled by Republican legislatures. Hopefully it becomes bipartisan more so in the future. It should be bipartisan. If you look at polling, it is when you ask voters. Just so happens that the Democratic Party is a wholly owned subsidiary of the teachers union at this point. I mentioned the donations earlier from Randy Weingarten going to the Democratic campaign coffers. Almost all their contributions go to the Democrats and not the Republicans. It's an elaborate money laundering scheme that ought to be illegal. But I think it will become more bipartisan if Republicans win on the issue of education freedom. We saw this kind of happen in Virginia with Glenn Youngkin. He beat Terry McAuliffe, who was basically an incumbent, the former governor of Virginia. In a state that went 10 points to Biden the year before, Glenn Youngkin, the Republican, won on the issue of education freedom by 6 points with education voters. And that was the number two issue in that election. So that basically never happens with Republicans. But I think he laid out a blueprint for success by talking about education in terms of parental rights, getting more of a say in the classroom, and also having school choice at the same time. I live in Texas, so I'll finish off with the fact that school choice has become a political winner. We had 21 Republicans who voted against school choice with all the Democrats in the House last year. It passed the Senate easily, 18 to 13. Universal school choice bill moved over to the House that had a lot of people. 18 of those 21 were already endorsed by the state affiliate of the largest teachers union in the country, the National Education Association. And some of them were previously endorsed by Randy Weingarten's state affiliate as well. But after they killed school choice last year, five of the 21 were not going to run for re-election. They saw the writing on the wall. They saw the shift in primary voters' attitudes towards education freedom. And so out of the remaining incumbents who voted against school choice, my organization, the American Federation for Children, our Super PAC AFC Victory Fund, targeted 13 of those lawmakers for voting against school choice, and we beat six of them outright on election night, and four more of them are heading into runoffs on May 28th. So that basically never happens. 77% of the incumbents we targeted for voting against school choice either lost or were forced into runoffs in most of them in second place. And incumbents usually win re-election about 95% of the time. So it's hard to overstate how much of a political earthquake rocked Texas on Super Tuesday. And the story there is that school choice supporters were victorious, and those who voted against school choice against their own party platform were ousted. And we have more elections coming up, but it looks like we now are going to have the votes in 2025 to have Texas go all in on school choice too.
All right. Will, would you like to add anything before we go? He's like, nope. All right.
I said, I think that was a good final summer.
There you go. Well, he is Corey DeAngelis, senior fellow at the American Federation for Children. Corey, thanks for joining us.
All right. Thanks, Charles and Will. God bless the U.S. of A. Land of the free and a home of the brave. God get all of the praise. I got a country to save, 'cause I'm Patriot J and I'm saving a day.